The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Kurt Schlichter is here today. Colonel Kurt, of course, the subject of some controversy last week. I think you heard our explication of the hearsay rule using Kurt as a teaching aid. I hope there will be no revenge. I hope he goes easy on Larry O'Connor. But Dwayne is there to listen in and report back to me next week. In the meantime, Colonel Kurt, take it away.
Thank you, Hugh Hewitt. This is Kurt Schlichter here in the Relief Factor studio in beautiful Southern California. The home of cargo shorts, flip-flops, and 72 degrees every single day. Yes, I was the human bar exam for Hugh Hewitt last week on the hearsay rule. And, of course, I am a noted Los Angeles trial lawyer. I am a retired United States Army colonel. I am the senior columnist at townhall.com. I want you to go to townhall.com right now and read my column. It's called Dems Feel the Agony of Defeat, and it's awesome. Look, I am a former cavalry officer. I screen the right flank for Hugh Hewitt. Where Hugh is sober and measured, I pull out my saber, point it towards the enemy, and charge on my stallion, leading my squadron into battle. That's who I am. I am also the author, and you can see it behind me here. If you're in the Hughiverse, you can see my new book. We'll be back, The Fall and Rise of America, which comes out on Tuesday from Regnery Books. It is, I guess it's one of the greatest books ever written by a human being. It's not quite divinely inspired, but it's pretty good. And you're saying, gosh, this guy is sure modest. I am a Los Angeles trial lawyer. I am not modest. I am a cavalry officer. I eschew modesty. You know, when somebody is modest, I figure they know something I don't. I like to think of myself as honest and self-actualized. And also someone who's profoundly grateful for having the opportunity to be here with you, guest hosting for the great Hugh Hewitt, on a pretty momentous day. Now, this is one of those days where you prep the night before for the Hugh Hewitt radio program, and then you come in and everything's all gone to heck. Boris Johnson. Over in Old Blighty, the green and pleasant land, home of bands such as The Clash and Joy Division, and The Who, of course. Well, he's going. Boris Johnson is going. Boris Johnson, he's the Prime Minister of Great Britain. He looks like a hobo, stuffed into a $5,000 suit. And he's going to resign today. He's had something like 50. Is producer Dwayne around? No, he's gone. Everybody's gone. I'm abandoned here. Much like Boris Johnson. I think something in the area of 50 of various ministers and, functionaries in the party have just cashed in their chips. They've resigned because Boris Johnson is wounded and bleeding. He is the wildebeest on the veldt with a bum hoof. And the hyenas are circling. He's going down today. He will probably go down when we're on the air. And oh my gosh, if you're in the universe, you see my hair right now is looking like Boris Johnson's. So that's my tribute to the soon-to-be former prime minister. And it's quite a fall for the guy. He led the Conservatives to probably their greatest victory in a century in 2019. They were winning ridings, seats in the parliament in places that had voted Labor for 100 years. And I'm not sure if that was a tribute to the power of Boris Johnson's vision or the fact that the Laborites are insane leftist lunatics. It's unclear. But what is clear is that Boris Johnson has pretty much shot himself in the foot between the parties during COVID. You know, he was locking down people and then he'd go back to number 10 and it was party time with the gang. Let the champagne flow. You can't do that as a leader. You cannot do that as a leader unless it's California and you're Gavin Newsom, our glorious governor hairstyle, who goes out to the French Laundry while locking down normal Americans and he's partying with his unmasked pals. Now, of course, I'm not a great believer in masks. I think they're kind of dumb. It's like putting a fishing net around your mouth. But in any case, you must lead by example. And that's something I learned as a squadron commander, deputy brigade commander in the Army. You've got to lead by example. You know, you've got to be the guy who eats last. You make sure your troops are taken care of. That's what you need to do as a leader. Boris Johnson did not do that. And unfortunately, he doesn't have a, you know, constituency of lunatics like Gavin Newsom does. I got to hand it to progressivism. They can take a state like California full of beauty and resources and talented, hardworking people and turn it into a hellhole, except for the blue enclaves, the kind of blue enclave I live in. You know, everybody always asks me, Kurt, why do you still live in California? And I say, because I am a trial lawyer and all of California is designed to serve people like me. So they basically roll up a dump truck full of money into my driveway every day because I'm like the dream progressive Californian. I'm a trial lawyer. I'm a parasite of human misery, except I'm a conservative Christian former Army officer, which allows me to be actually diversity for most of the people I know here in California. They're like, well, I know a conservative Christian military guy. It's Kurt. He's all three of those things. So I check the boxes for my liberal friends to say, no, I've got one of the some of my best friends are Christian conservative military veterans. And that's Kurt. All in one package. We've got quite the package for you guys today. We're going to be talking about a lot of stuff. We'll be talking to Matt Bentley a little later about various things, including his new novel and his take on foreign policy. That's going to be interesting. And we've got Dr. Michael Oren coming, former Israeli deputy prime minister. Now, you may think that Great Britain is chaotic. You may think the United States is chaotic. And we got some clips from Joe Biden because he is Joe Biden is in full effect. So when you roll up to a gas station, remember, you're paying for $7 gas because of Putin, even though, you know, it was Joe Biden who kind of, you know, shut down our oil industry and who's been selling our strategic oil reserves and then shipping it to China, which sounds like a really, really great idea. You may think that we're chaotic, but the Israelis, holy cow, what are they on, the 58th election in like the last month? I mean, holy cow. It's like the Italian parliament back in the 70s. They had like 72 governments, and now that's the Israelis. What is it about countries that begin with the letter I? Dwayne, do you have any idea what's going on with this? What is it? Is it countries that begin with I or chaotic? What's going to happen in Ireland?
Well, that's, Northern Ireland's actually going to have issues as well. Scotland wants to leave. There's all sorts of fun that's
ahead
the next few years.
My ancestors came from Scotland, from Falkirk, from the MacCullaghs. And I look at what Scotland's become. Yeah. Now, mine were hardscrabble, hardworking, not very nice people. And now the Scots are a bunch of politically correct commies who you can't understand because they're drunk and slurring their words. I think, you know, my mom, who she's 83, blind, nearly deaf, former judge, she put it this way: I got no use for Europeans. They were the ones too weak to come to America. She's pretty cool. Mom's pretty amazing.
I bet mom would be a kick.
Mom's pretty interesting. She, you know, it's getting, dad passed away, so she's alone with a caregiver. So I get calls like, I'm missing my forks. And it's like,
Dad was the only one that knew where the forks were?
No, this is 50-year-old flatware, right, that I grew up on a kid.
Gotcha.
And she's like, look, they're putting the forks somewhere. But she's sharp, too, man. She comes out, Kurt, I want you to explain the, because I can't read it. I need you to explain the reasoning in Dobbs to me. Was that a substantive due process analysis? That's, you know.
That's mom.
So that's kind of where we're at. Gosh, we only have 1 minute left in this segment, but in the next segment, I'm gonna play for you some amazing Joe Biden stuff, because he was pretty in effect yesterday, huh?
He was on his Joe Biden game in Cleveland, where the Democrat governor candidate Nan Whaley was not in attendance,
and nor was
Tim Ryan, who's from there,
and who's a friend of the show,
and is a friend of the show.
You know, he wants nothing to do with you. He said, "I want to be the face of my campaign." Yeah, no one wants that withered, crusty face.
And there's 26 reasons why they weren't there, and that is the percent that Joe Biden is popular in Ohio.
Well, we got so much going on. We are on Boris Johnson resign watch here on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. I'm guest host Kurt Schlichter, author of We'll Be Back. And we will be back. Stick around. Back on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. I am guest host Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at townhall.com. Read my new article there today. It's a great column, if I say so myself, and I do. I'm a noted trial lawyer, retired United States Army colonel, author of the new book, We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, which you must go get because it comes out Tuesday. Go pre-order it now. Now, why would I have Mr. Rogers singing It's a Wonderful Day in the Neighborhood? Because the author of The Neighborhood, a new thriller coming out this August, is joining us now. Matthew Bentley. How are you, Matt?
Hey, I'm doing great, brother. How are you? We're both doing better than Boris Johnson.
Oh, my gosh. And I wanted to get your take on it. You are not only a thriller writer, you are a observer of foreign affairs. You are a Marine Corps veteran of Iraq. Thank you for your service. And you are many and myriad other things. But I want to get your take on what the imminent resignation of Boris the Mess Johnson, because he looks like his hair was thrown at him in the morning. He looks like a hobo in a $5,000 suit, and acts with that level of responsibility and coherence. What do you think the effect of the change at the top in the British government is going to be?
Well, who knows what the change in the top of the British government is going to be? I mean, look at all the problems they had, how many decades it took to get Brexit going, and then once they decided to do it, how many referendums they had to have. So nothing in any government moves quickly. But what I find amusing more than anything else, I admit, I wasn't even aware there was a brewing scandal. I woke up and
yeah, me too.
The prime minister's resigning. I'm like, what did he do?
I'm prepping for the show last night, and I'm thinking, okay, I've got these topics. We'll talk about we'll talk to Matt Bentley about his new thriller, The Neighborhood, and we will cover that in this segment. And then I wake up and I do my last minute show prep, and I'm like, holy cow, America's arguably America's number one ally is having a change in leadership. And it comes 2 years after he won an enormous mandate from the British people to support Brexit, to support conservative policies. He never supported conservative policies, did he?
No, not really. But that's what he ran on, at least their version of conservatism over there. But what I find hysterical is I figured he must have murdered someone overnight. You know, like maybe he pulled like some wild binge involving, you know, cocaine and girls and guys, who knows, whatever. And instead, it's supposedly because he was aware of allegations that some guy groped another guy that he had appointed. And I'm thinking, that's all it took to get this guy out. Now, obviously, you
allowing his country to be flooded by illegal aliens, after not imposing the conservative policies they promised, after having the parties during the COVID lockdown. I want to talk to you about that in a second, because you're a Marine officer. You know the importance of setting an example. A couple guys are playing footsie and he's out because of that. Seems odd. But then again, it's Britain.
Exactly. It's Britain. And it just goes back to the hypocrisy. If you look at, compare that to what we've got here, we've got a president who is almost intentionally trying to send us into some sort of socialist version of Venezuela where people are going to end up having to eat their pets. And nothing happens to this guy. Nothing happens to our president. But Johnson's out over allegations of groping, you know, obviously that's the icing on the British cake, but still, it's kind of crazy. But then again, we have a media here that has put President Biden inside a bubble, and it's almost impossible to penetrate it until we actually have an election.
Well, that's certainly true, Matthew Bentley. Now, you are a Marine Corps officer. You served in Fallujah, I believe.
I did.
You understand the importance of setting the example. And one of the things that really started the downward spiral for Boris Johnson is during COVID, he was very much a lockdown kind of guy. And then he goes and has,
like Gavin Newsom.
Yeah, but Gavin Newsom managed to skate. Boris Johnson's having these parties during lockdown at number 10 Downing Street. And then it came out and the people were mad. Why is setting an example, that is, as a leader, sharing the burdens of your troops or as a leader of a country of your citizens, so important? Because I think a lot of politicians like Boris Johnson, who never served in his country's military, I think to his detriment. Why is it so important? And why is that such an essential part of the ethics of a Marine Corps and an Army officer?
Well, it goes back to being able to have the confidence of the men and women that you lead over and serve with. Because as a leader, it's your job to serve with the people that are under you. And if you don't have their confidence, you can't do your job. You know, as a Marine officer, I failed many times, and I learned from every one of those failures.
Oh, man. That's why they don't allow your lieutenant or officer evaluations to follow you through your career.
Yeah, exactly. But that's part of the learning process. The problem is you have politicians like Boris Johnson, like our president, like Governor Newsom, who have no actual integrity and don't understand the value of leadership and integrity and setting the example. They're doing whatever they want because they think they can, and they're imposing crazy mandates like Governor Newsom did on state employees, not allowing them to go to Montana when he just visited the state.
Exactly.
Himself.
And it's so galling and it's so outrageous. And I'm very disappointed, my fellow Californians, for allowing it. Now, let's switch gears, because you did something people only dreamed of. You were a Marine officer. You left the Marine Corps. And you, I know your story because we're good friends and I've heard it many times. One day you're reading a popular thriller and you're saying, this is boring. I'm going to write my own. You did. You created the Logan West series of novels. They were top sellers. And now you've got a new one called The Neighborhood coming out. Tell us, I mean, you made your dream come true, as I did. I've got my new book, We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, my 10th book. You and I both came out of the military. We both had some to say, and we just went and did it, and we've both been successful. Well, before we talk more about The Neighborhood, tell us what your advice is to authors who have a dream of being published.
Well, I'm a bit of a realist on this, because I first started writing Overwatch. My first book, which came out in 2016, and was debuted as a Military Times Top 10 and nominated for the Best Thriller of 2016. But I started writing that book in 2010, and it is a brutal, brutal process to get to where I was very fortunate to get to. It took me 18 months to write the book, another year to get an agent, and then 14 months before I had my first deal with Simon & Schuster for the Logan West series. But what I tell people is you have to be able to deal with the rejection, because every step of the process in publishing is designed to make you quit. You have to have your own motivation.
Does that remind you of Marine Corps officer candidate school? Because it reminds me of Army officer candidate school.
No, it's completely the same thing. And I thank the Marine Corps every day for the discipline that instilled in me to keep going. Because I've talked to plenty of authors who are like, oh, my God, it took all that. I'm like, yes, it did. I submitted 92 query letters to agents before number 83 said, oh, my God, this book's fantastic. We want to represent you. But that's what it takes. It's just, and if you don't have that determination, and obviously you have to have talent, you have to be able to write, but if you have to be able to deal with the process that really does want to stop you at every step of the way.
I think Matt Bentley, author of The Neighborhood, that being able to write well is only the first step. Being able to get the thing published and being able to market is another key thing. Now, I have had the pleasure of reading The Neighborhood. I got it early. My wife has read it as well. She's a big Matt Bentley fan, which I no doubt is soothing your already ample ego, because you are a Marine and you're not exactly modest, nor should you be if you're a Marine. It's a good book. It's a really wild ride. Tell us a little about The Neighborhood and when it comes out and where people can pre-order it.
Sure. So The Neighborhood, I actually wrote a standalone thriller so that people who hadn't read my Logan West book could pick up The Neighborhood and get the kind of experience that I'm known for writing. So it is about a gated community 40 miles west of D.C. near the mountain that comes under siege in the middle of the night by an assault force looking for something that one of the residents has. It turns into this wild, intense hunt for this thing that they're looking for, and these neighbors have to band together to figure out how to survive the night, and then it turns into this super modern take on a spy thriller. And it all takes place in one contained environment, whereas usually I'm writing these huge, big, sweeping geopolitical action sets. I wanted to give a different kind of experience to the reader, and I'm thrilled about where it is. The book itself comes out on 9 August, and you know we're super excited.
Well, you can pre-order it, right?
Absolutely. Anywhere books are available, Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, all the big ones. And then, of course, you know, as you know, the book has already been picked up and is in development to be a major motion picture.
Well, that's pretty exciting. We just saw Jack Carr has the Amazon series, The Terminal List. There seems to be a real need for interesting content. Now, if we read your stuff, is it going to be woke? Is it going to be politically correct? Is it going to make us want to pound our heads against the wall because it's full of liberal nonsense, Matt Bentley?
Yeah, of course not. In fact, the one thing I've tried to do is I try, even though I'm an outspoken conservative, I try and keep my politics, for the most part, out
what?
Of my books, because I just want to entertain the reader. That is my job as a writer, is to entertain the reader.
Well, I've got to agree with you there, Matt Bentley. I want to entertain people with We'll Be Back, Fall and Rise of America. It is outspokenly conservative, but it is nonfiction. Thank you, Matthew Bentley. Go order The Neighborhood and stick around here on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program. I'm Kurt Schlichter. We'll be right back. We are back on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program. I am retired infantry colonel Kurt Schlichter. That, of course, Men of Harlech. From the quintessential British war movie Zulu. You may remember that powerful scene. Terrific film about warriors. And speaking of warriors, we've got one here, Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli Deputy Prime Minister for Diplomacy, a veteran of the IDF. Dr. Oren, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program.
Good to be with you, Kurt.
Well, as you know, Great Britain is in turmoil as we are on Boris Johnson resign watch. Israel and Great Britain have had a fraught relationship, at times shooting bullets at each other. How is this change going to affect British and Israeli relations, and how is that going to affect Israel's ability to defend itself?
Well, yeah, we haven't shot at each other for about 74 years, which is good.
Well, that's a good record.
But we have had a fraught relationship because, hey, frankly, the British government's position is not all that far removed from the Democratic Party's position on the Palestinian issue, on the Iran issue. The big change came with Boris Johnson, and I've had a chance to work with him a bit. A man of extraordinary intellect, yes, out of the box completely, but I think a person who understood us very well. I mean, not really since Margaret Thatcher had we had a prime minister of Britain who really understood us deeply in that way. And he'll be missed. I think that Britain will continue to exercise a certain amount of influence here. The British embassy is highly respected here. We just had a big celebration for the Queen's Jubilee, and all of Israeli leadership showed up. It was quite beautiful. It's a complex relationship, but a very close relationship. We would like them to understand our position better, certainly on the Palestinians, but most importantly, strategically on the Iranian issue.
Well, Dr. Warren, I want to talk a little more about understanding Israeli position as it applies to the United States and, frankly, the undercutting of our ally Israel by our State Department. But first, there's a little chaos going on in Israel's government, too. What the heck is happening? You guys are trying to take the title from Italy for the most changes of governments and elections.
I think we already got the title. That's the bad news, Kurt.
Wow.
We beat them out for the most elections, 55 elections in just about over 2 years. It's pretty crazy. Listen, it all boils down to two words, and those two words are Benjamin Netanyahu, who remains by far the most popular politician in this country, the person who most Israelis think is most qualified to be prime minister. But the heads of other parties don't like him and won't form a coalition with him. So we're going to go to the polls again. And right now, the chances are we're going to have exactly the same outcome because we still have the same percentage of the population, which is right wing, left wing, secular, religious, Arab, Jewish. Nothing's changed. And so unless, you know, some cue ball comes in and knocks the other balls around, nothing's going to change. And Netanyahu shows no sign of leaving the political sphere. Well, so the chaos, like I say, right now, as of this morning, looks like it might continue.
Well, Dr. Warren, are elections scheduled?
For the 1st of November right now.
Holy cow. So it's going to be several months before you even have a hope of getting organized. The fact is, Israel's facing an existential threat right now in the form of Iran. And unfortunately, the present United States administration, particularly our State Department, seems intent on undercutting our ally Israel. The State Department's actually really, really messing with you guys and taking the side of Israel's enemies right now. I find it shocking. What's happening?
Well, it's not so much taking the side of our enemies. The State Department did something which I think was inconsistent with relations between allied nations, even between sovereign nations that aren't allied. You know, we had the situation of this Palestinian-American journalist, Shireen Abu-Akleh, who was killed in a crossfire on May 11th. And she's one of 2,700 journalists, listen to this, Kurt, who have been killed in action since 1990. Now, none of these killings, almost none of them have been investigated. Yet Abu-Akleh's killing was investigated by the New York Times, the CNN, by the Wall Street, by the Washington Post. Massive investigations. All of them found Israel guilty. But there's one problem. They didn't have the bullet. The Palestinian Authority kept the bullet and wouldn't let anybody see the bullet. And you know, as a military man, if you don't have the bullet, you don't know who fired the gun, right?
Well,
you know that.
Well, if everybody's using 5.56 or 7.62, kind of hard to figure out who it came from, even
exactly.
If you did
they,
have
they
it.
Have 5.56 too.
Yes.
They use American weaponry. We use American weaponry. They have some Kalashnikovs, which are 7.62,
yep.
But this was a 5.56
Okay.
Bullet. I knew it was going to be a 5.56 bullet. I said to a journalist the night that it happened, I says, watch, the Palestinians are going to produce a 5.56 bullet. And they did. And they wouldn't give over the bullet. Finally, the State Department convinced the Palestinians under tremendous pressure to let observers come from the State Department and look at the bullet. And they looked at the bullet, and they said the bullet had deteriorated beyond the point where they could actually make a determination which gun fired the bullet. But then the State Department came out and said, we think Israel's guilty anyway.
Oh, look,
now,
I understand.
I mean, holy, holy moly.
Well,
you know, why don't you just undercut our sovereignty, undercut our military, undercut our investigation, which is detailed and serious?
Well,
very insulting.
Well, Dr. Warren, you're a diplomat, so you have to be diplomatic. I'm an American citizen, and I've got to tell you, our government is screwing up, undercutting our ally Israel. This is Kurt Schlichter. I'm guest hosting for the great Hugh Hewitt. I'm the author of We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, which you need to go get. And you need to stick around for the next couple hours here on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Morning Glory America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Kurt Schlichter is here today. Colonel Kurt, of course, the subject of some controversy last week. I think you heard our explication of the hearsay rule using Kurt as a teaching aid. I hope there will be no revenge. I hope he goes easy on Larry O'Connor. But Dwayne is there to listen in and report back to me next week. In the meantime, Colonel Kurt, take it away.
Thank you, Hugh Hewitt. This is Kurt Schlichter, Human Bar Exam, with assistance by my friend Larry O'Connor. Who am I? I am the senior columnist at townhall.com. You may want to go read my new article, Dems Feel the Agony of Defeat, and it's awesome over there at Town Hall, where it is the number one trending article. Very proud of that. I am a retired United States Army colonel. I am a noted Los Angeles trial lawyer. I am also an author. And my new book, Will Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, drops from Regnery next Tuesday. You must go pre-order it. I'm very pleased to bring in our next guest, Leland Vitter of News Nation Now. He's the anchor over there. I think I've been on with him a couple times back when he was on Fox. Leland, how are you doing? Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
Hey, long time no talk, my friend. It's good to hear from you.
Well, it's good to hear from you, and I think you're a great person to talk to today, as we are on Boris Johnson resignation watch. And if it wasn't the top of the hour, I'd have some Clash as the bumper music. Maybe somebody got murdered, London's burning, London calling, something appropriate. Let me ask you, how, as a American news anchor, do you cover a foreign story that requires a little in-depth knowledge? Because it's kind of esoteric what's happening over there with the British prime minister, because Americans are, well, sadly, pretty parochial. How do you do that as a reporter in America?
Excellent question, and one which, thankfully, I have another 12 hours more airtime to figure out. because it's very hard. The British prime minister, I think my initial takeaway from this is how this affects President Biden's ability to operate overseas, right? Because for so long, President Biden told us that when he was a candidate, that him coming into office would bring America back, right? And that this was going to be the renaissance of American foreign policy, that in his mind, in his supporters' minds, President Trump left behind. And Boris Johnson was the original Trump, if you will, Brexit and everything else. I think that probably is the way you have to cover it and bring it back to the United States, bring it back to how you've had Boris Johnson really leading the moral cause in Ukraine. We did a piece, probably now 4 months ago, comparing Boris Johnson and his visit to Kyiv during the war as something akin to Winston Churchill, who was taking the great moral stand of our time against Vladimir Putin, and the fact that he's now leaving and will no longer be that counterweight, perhaps, to whatever you think of President Biden's foreign policy, is significant.
Well, I try not to think of President Biden's foreign policy. But look, it seems to me that as an American reporter, you have you're juggling a number of different balls, because you're going to, as you said, you're going to focus on the effect of the United States, which makes sense because you have an American audience. But it also requires that you have to educate and teach, which is something about various things like. Enough about how the British system works and how it's different from us to an American audience that, frankly, isn't always that aware of how our own government works. And then you got to talk about Boris Johnson's unique issues, and then you got to talk about the problems with Boris Johnson. I find it's similar when I talk to juries. I have to somehow educate them to the world of the trial, whether it's an automaker or bank or whatever, and how things work in that milieu. How do you boil it down enough so it makes some sense to the audience?
It's a great point. I think one of the things that is very refreshing about News Nation, about at least the show that I get to do every night and have the privilege of coming on for 60 minutes every night, is that we're able to really go in depth on certain issues. We're able to spend 6, 8, 10 minutes on one topic. So you get the time when it's something that we think is really important to explain how it works, explain why it's important, and then to talk about it rather than just having to talk about it in the 45 seconds. This is what the Conservative Party says. This is why Boris Johnson's in trouble. This is what the Liberal Party says or Labour Party says in the UK. Thank you very much. And next topic. So that gives us an enormous leg up, I think, on stories like this that require a lot of nuance and a lot of understanding of whatever the given topic is. I wonder with Boris Johnson resigning, what this says about the populist movement that we saw that probably started with Brexit, right? That was the big surprise in sort of world politics. You had this huge surprise with Brexit. Then you had this huge surprise with Donald Trump winning. That if we're not starting to see the rollback of that probably a little bit, and now I'm going to get pretty wonky, but with Emmanuel Macron winning a re-election, when that was sort of seen as what would have been the next domino to fall had Marie Le Pen taken over. So there's my wonkiness for the morning.
Well, look, you're talking about wonkiness. Of course, wonkiness is just detail. And as a trial lawyer, I have to make it interesting for the jury because these are 12 people who couldn't talk their way out of jury duty. They get bored. You know, there's nothing worse than doing an examination or an argument. You look over and you see eyes rolled back in their heads. You have to keep an audience because there is a for lack of a better word, entertainment value, even to presenting news. You can't be dull. How do you make talking about interscene Conservative Party politics in Great Britain interesting to American audience because it's important. Britain is arguably our closest ally.
Well, we have the great special relationship. The other way to flip that around, and you're right to point out that there's nothing worse than seeing people's eyes roll back, except they don't have a clicker. Television remote to turn you off.
It's a lot worse if they're laughing at you during your closing argument. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I've heard. So, of course, never happened to me.
Of course, it's only happened to some friends of yours.
Exactly.
But I think what you do is you try to find the personalities because in the end, the way people connect is about emotion and about personality, and about people because that's what we all are. We all enjoy that. In a weird way, why politics has become so tribal in America, because it's almost like become like sports. It used to be we were really passionate about the Cubs or the Cardinals or the Bears or the Steelers or whatever the pro sports teams. And you could have these really passionate conversations with somebody about something that really didn't matter. And we kind of got used to that. And now politics become our national sport, if you will, that people enjoy being super passionate about. And it all comes down to personalities. And I think that's what we will, as we endeavor to try and cover this today, what we'll have to make it about.
Well, Leland Vittert of News Nation Now, that's an interesting point because it kind of dovetails with, for lack of a better word, the great man theory of history, which has been repudiated by a lot of history. They want to talk about systems. They want to talk about culture, but not the influence of a great man or a great personality. And of course, that seems to be your focus because you were talking about a comparison between Winston Churchill, arguably the greatest man of the last millennium. I could see somebody making that argument, and I think I'm likely to buy it. As opposed to trying to talk about a more systemic approach, what's it mean to the British system? Is that how it seems like a really good way to engage the audience, but also illuminate what's going on?
Well, I'm not a historian. I'm not a philosopher either. But I think that the discussion of systems in plans is all well and good. In our forms of government, whether it really be in Russia or the United States or Great Britain or whatever it is, the form of government is different. But in the end, it does come down to one man or a couple of men and their personalities. So I think if you want to sit around and talk about the system, I'm sure there's a place to read about that or to listen to it. I'm thinking maybe NPR.
Oh, that hurts. Ouch. Leland Vitter, anchorman at News Nation Now. Thank you for joining us on a Hugh Hewitt radio program. I'm guest host Kurt Schlichter. We'll be right back. The faraway towns, now war is together. We're back on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. That's The Clash with London Calling. And Prime Minister Boris Johnson is on the tube right now. As his career goes down the tubes, it looks like he's resigning. We will see how that develops. And there are few people better to be talking about it than the representative of New York's 3rd District, a United States Army officer and a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, candidate for governor of the Empire State, Representative Lee Zeldin. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, wow, we're going to talk about your candidacy for governor against the unelected person who is currently misruling your beautiful state. But as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the United States House of Representatives, what does the imminent resignation of Boris Johnson mean to the United States?
This is an alliance for our country where when we think of our economy and trade, we want to see a stable Europe. We want to see stability with allies all across the entire world. I mean, for us here in the United States, I'm somebody who prioritizes America first, and what is best for United States is always should always be the guiding light and through these policy decisions. If you were to have an ideal setting across the world, you would have nations like the UK, like Israel in their region, and you could pick these other nations in other spots of the globe where you want their country to be secure and stable and their economy to be strong. And we're seeing impacts here in our own country where friction abroad is causing negativity here at home. Now, President Biden wants to blame instability abroad, blame Putin for everything. Unfortunately, you see the extreme of where the blame ends up going, and you end up having a lack of accountability at the top here at home. So that's been to the extent of spin and misinformation. But I think where we all should be on the same page on as Americans is that we have these other countries that we want them to be able to get through these moments as easily as possible. I remember when Boris Johnson came in, it was a moment where their country was rebelling against push for illegal immigration, and the Europe the alliances within that region were growing, and the currency debate was on fire. And Boris came on, from the conservative standpoint to, try to balance out what was a Corbynism. We saw it with the anti-Semitism push inside of the UK. Just amazing how much the issues have shifted. The priorities have changed, and I really do wish the best for the UK, because that I think is what's best for us here at home.
Well, Representative Lee Zeldin, member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I have a dual question. I have a question and a follow-up. You're a fellow lawyer, so you know that's going to be tricky. The first question is, what will the reaction of the United States be to this resignation of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister of Great Britain? And what do you think its reaction should be?
President Biden probably will just try to find this as a, as an excuse for anything negative that happens with our economy today and in the days and the weeks that come. If
the Boris Johnson price hike at the pump.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you see the price of gas or a loaf of bread or the cost of chicken go up tomorrow, it's the Boris Johnson increase. So from that standpoint, I would expect to see our administration seek to use it to blame for a lot of what's going on wrong right now in our country. How should we react? From that standpoint, I want to see our administration taking responsibility for what is happening under its watch. Just to shoot straight and say this is exactly what's going on wrong in our own country. This is my responsibility as the president of the United States to do something about it. Here are my ideas. This is my plan. But that is just a very different world, a different reality in what we're facing right now with this president.
Well, Representative Lee Zeldin, you are looking to take responsibility for the Empire State from your unelected current governor. You're the Republican nominee in 2022 for the governorship. And I look at this current governor, especially she just seems like a disaster, especially if you take something like the recent Supreme Court decision on guns, which was designed to allow people to keep and bear arms without arbitrary government decisions about whether you're allowed to actually have your right. And of course, in the new law, that's exactly what she did by saying, you must now show good character to the satisfaction of some government bureaucrat without any kind of actual objective criteria, and even turn over your social media history for approval by some bureaucrat. What is up with this terrible, terrible chief executive in the Empire State?
The Supreme Court issued the right decision on the case. New York's concealed carry law did go too far. It was unconstitutional. Kathy Hochul responds with one-party Democrat rule up in Albany by going even stricter. You could argue this is even more unconstitutional than what the Supreme Court just overturned. So the disdain for the Constitution, the disdain for the United States Supreme Court is a huge red flag alone. But during a press conference, she was asked, what data do you have to be targeting law-abiding New Yorkers who want to safely and securely carry a firearm solely for their own personal self-defense? And she said she doesn't need data. Now, a few months ago, this
that's going to come back and haunt her when these laws are inevitably challenged.
Yeah, just a few months ago, no doubt. And just a few months ago when she was getting pushed to repeal cashless bail, which has been a disaster in the state, her response was she couldn't repeal it because she doesn't have the data, even though she did. And by the way, Kathy Hochul was an A-rated NRA-endorsed member of Congress who is doing this massive flip-flop, just like we saw Kirsten Gillibrand do when she went from being a House Democrat to being a statewide elected official here in this state. It is unconstitutional. It is poorly written. I'll give you one example. The Adirondacks is a park in New York, which is massive. It spans many, many different counties. It's huge. Now, under this bill, you can't carry inside of a park. So you have this massive span of the state where you're saying that everybody in this entire region of New York, you can't carry at all. You're disarmed. You have no Second Amendment rights to carry for your self-defense because you're in this area that's been designated as a park. We're not talking about a few acres here. We're talking about a massive swath of land. So it's also very poorly crafted. It was rushed. It's just another reason why Kathy Hochul has to go. Anybody who views the Constitution as a threat to their lust for power and control, they have just absolutely disqualified themselves from holding office.
Well, Lee Zeldin, running for governor in the formerly great state of New York, and I feel your pain because I'm in California. New York has a reputation as being a very, very liberal state. How are you going to beat a Democratic candidate?
Well, people look at the Republican and Democratic enrollment difference. They often don't look at the millions of registered voters who aren't Republican or Democrat. And right now, they're polling like Republicans in another year. There's a big enthusiasm gap as well. The people who plan on voting Republican in November are much more excited about it than the people who plan on voting Democrat. the top two issues right now in the state, crime and the economy. We're on the right side of the issue. Kathy Hochul is absolutely on the wrong side of those issues. We started early. We're working hard. There are a lot of Democrats who are disenfranchised Democrats. They feel like their party has left them. There's a lot of people who want balance, and they're thinking about their own future in the state, and they're hitting their breaking point, and they're realizing that the trajectory that this state is on right now, we are going to be experiencing rock bottom if Kathy Hochul has 4 years. She's making a bad first impression on people who didn't know her. She's making an even worse impression on people who have known her because they know that the person she's acting like now is not the person she's always been. And we started early. We're working hard. We're taking nothing for granted. And I am not in this race to come in second.
Well, Lee Zeldin running for governor in New York State. What is you're a military guy like I am. I don't know. Have you gone to the war college yet? You're a lieutenant colonel.
I have not gone yet. No.
Okay. Well, don't go to the Army War College if you can help it. It's the Party War College. The toga parties are legendary, though.
Oh, my gosh.
But you're a look, you're a strategy guy. What is your strategy to have a conservative Republican beat a liberal governor in a liberal state? What are the key factors? We only have about 15 seconds or 30 seconds, and then I need you to tell us how we can help you.
You focus on the issues that matter most to New Yorkers, and you know we should be bringing spending under control, cut taxes across the board, and reverse the ban on the safe extraction of natural gas. Hey, that all helps the economy. You want to make the streets of New York safer? Fire the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, repeal cashless bail, and enact a law enforcement bill of rights and more to make our streets safe again.
How can we help you?
ZeldinForNewYork.com, ZeldinForNewYork.com, ZeldinForNewYork.com. Great to be on with you, Kurt.
Thank you, Lee Zeldin, future governor of New York State. I am guest host Kurt Schlichter here on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. I want you to stick around. We've got a lot more to come. America, and I have a guest here, a good friend of mine, Jim Garrity, National Review Online, and of course, author of The Morning Jolt, which I read every day. Jim Garrity, let's get to the most important issue of the day. My book. are you super excited about it or just moderately excited about this book, which drops on July 12th?
I am psyched, Kurt. I always am for all of your books. I enjoy the fiction. I enjoy the nonfiction. I just want to point out, though, I heard that little preview from Hugh saying that he was out, you were sitting in for him, and that there was a little bit of controversy surrounding you last week. Did he pre-tape that like years ago and they just run it every time? Because is there a week where there isn't some grand controversy over something you've written in a town hall column or something like that?
it's called an evergreen.
There you go. Okay, I was going to say, it works for all circumstances. You know, somewhere in the taking it says, you know, insert Kurt Schlichter controversy here, you know.
Yeah, controversy du jour in France. And, of course, right across, here's my smooth guest host segue, right across the channel from France is Great Britain. And there's been a doings a transpiring in there as the hobo in the $5,000 suit has resigned as head of, as the Prime Minister of Great Britain. What do you think the effect of that's going to be?
Sure. Well, I don't spend an enormous amount of time following British politics, but thankfully my colleagues do. And there's a general sense that this has been a snowball that rolling down a hill and just accumulates more and more weight. Boris Johnson entered office with this reputation for being undisciplined but brilliant. And yes, you're right. He looks like this guy who just got out of bed no matter what time of day it is.
I know. Look at that hair. It's remarkable. It's almost Trumpian.
And there's this goofy charm to him. He does things that would seem like everybody's running the footage of him, you know, zip lining and getting caught in his suit and waving the flag. He can do things. And I guess because I feel like the Boris Johnson, Donald Trump parallels, I can kind of see him, but I think it's not the most relevant one. I think that you have to really kind of squint. I think they're very different personalities, different educations, different life experiences. The comparison that I think is really more relevant, it's not surprising me that a lot of people in our mainstream media don't want to make that comparison. Look, inflation in the UK right now is 9.1%. They already had a very high cost of living. They already had a housing shortage. They already had
open borders.
All kinds of mounting economic and social problems, and there's just a general sense that the guy in charge is just not up to the task of tackling them. there's this sense that it's getting worse, and the people who are elites in the government are kind of walled off from the gritty reality of what the average person experiences. And as a result of it, they're just not tackling these problems with any sense of urgency. Hey, Kurt, does any of that sound familiar here in the United States?
Well, thank you for making my segue for me. The wolves were circling Boris Johnson in Britain, and eventually the gazelle that is Boris Johnson, which is just a terrible analogy. I guess he's more of a wacky wildebeest.
Sort of hippo, yeah.
Yeah, he's gone down. But when are the wolves really going to start circling Joe Biden? Now, a couple of them have nipped at his hooves, but no one's come out and said, you guys know he's senile, right? And we can't really do this again. When's that going to happen? Because it's got to happen.
Shortly, you know, right around Afghanistan debacle, I had written a piece. I think it was one of the most read pieces I had last year, which was titled, very simple title, Something is Wrong with the President. And I pointed out that he had not been seen in 4 days. He was not taking questions. He would issue these short statements and then turn and not take any questions. And then when he finally did the sit-down interview with George Stephanopoulos, we had the infamous, that was 4 or 5 days ago, man. And general sense that this is not a president who's he's not capable of interacting with people. And the sense that all of our suspicions that he was being hidden from the cameras, clearly something's wrong. Clearly he's capable of being in front of the cameras for short stretches. Clearly he's capable of, I think he's probably, he turns 80 after the midterm elections. I think Joe Biden probably has like 4 or 5 good hours a day. And I think after that he gets tired. I think after that he needs his rest. He needs to go back to Delaware every weekend. You don't see him doing many night events.
He needs to get in his rocker, wrap up in a shawl, have his mush, and watch Matlock.
And it's one of those things where it's increasingly hard to hide this.
Is a Democrat going to come out and say what we're all seeing? Because, you know, that may be the path to power. He's not going to run in 2024. I can't imagine it. Well, actually, I can.
Yeah. There will be those around him who say, well, we did it in 2020. We can do it again. We can keep him. We can stage manage him. We can keep him up. By the way, when they try to give him the teleprompter and tell him to stay on it, you never know when he'll just blurt out,
God.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
Oh, jeez.
But he wasn't calling for regime change, you know, that kind of. His mind goes where
it's like that old Bullwinkle and Rocky cartoon where the little guy with the trash can and the broom follows them, sweeping up after them. That's what you have to do with President Gumby.
Yeah, so I think things like your illustrious governor, running the ad in Florida. I think, you know, J.B. Pritzker, I think the whole bunch of Democratic governors who are basically in the state of like, look, I'm not officially running for president. But if for some reason Democrats decide Biden can't run again and they have no faith in Kamala Harris, who's done the impossible and managed to have a lower approval rating than Biden does.
Well, Biden is polling right there with monkeypox.
Well, yeah.
I mean, he got 30. He's down to 30. How low can he go?
I was going to say, what you're seeing here in these really lousy polling numbers, it's not just like Republicans. We're really not inclined to give him much benefit of the doubt when he started the presidency. Maybe they gave it to him for that first month or two, and then they got tired of him. The independents, bit by bit, over 2021, started to abandon him. What you're seeing now is Democrats no longer quite so reticent about telling a pollster, yeah, I just can't support this guy. I can't pretend that things are going well. Right now, he has 75% approval amongst Democrats, which is still high. But remember, in today's era of great polarization, usually a president is getting about 90% support or higher among members of his own party. And so what it is 18% of Democrats are saying, yeah, I don't think he's doing a good job. And then about another 7% or so are like, I don't know, even when that's not listed.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm open-minded about Joe Biden. He seems pretty steady.
When you ask a Democrat, so what do you think of Joe Biden? What do you think of the job he's doing? I'm envisioning this long sigh.
A long, uncomfortable silence.
I don't know.
You know, if you can't say anything nice, tell the pollster, no opinion.
This capitulation, although not quite willing to say, I don't approve of the job he's doing. And again, how much of that 75% are gritting their teeth and saying, yes, I think things are going well in the country, you know.
Relatively well. I mean, it could be worse, theoretically. Look,
Jim Garrity, National Review. Everybody should sign up for the Morning Jolt. I do. I get it. Actually, I get it on two email accounts, so there's no missing it.
Doubling my subscription rate. Yes, thank you.
Woohoo! Ka-ching! Let me ask you something. I have a theory. As you know, I am a fan of Latinx Americans since I married one. I think the biggest underreported story of the last year is the massive shift of Hispanic voters to the point where it is now polling evenly Republican and Democrat. I think the Democrats invested heavily thinking that the Hispanic vote would be a permanent Democrat constituency. And I think Hispanic Americans said no es bueno. No está bueno. Gosh, I don't speak Spanish. Are going their own way because the Republican Party fits what they want. Do you agree with me that this is a significant and undercovered story? We got about 30 seconds.
Kurt, not only is this a major, significant, and undercovered story, I think that based on what we've seen in the past 2 years or so, considering the voting rates of Latino, Hispanic Americans, particularly those who are immigrants from countries that have suffered under socialism, and how they see America, how they see its values, and what they want to preserve. Kurt, at this point, if you come from a socialist country, I want open borders and an immediate path to citizenship.
Nice.
We're the ones we like. In fact, we are a country of immigrants. We're founded by give these people citizenship. I want them voting in these elections as much as possible.
Well, let me tell you, my Cuban family, not real open to the Democrats. But let's just put it that way. I'm Kurt Schlichter. That was great. Jim Garrity from National Review Online, Morning Jolt. Go subscribe. I'm the author of We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America. Go pre-order that sucker. You won't regret it. And we will be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program. Back on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program, I am guest host Kurt Schlichter. That, of course, is The Clash with Spanish Bombs off the classic double album, London Calling, one of the greatest albums of all time, and very appropriate today for many reasons, including the fact that Boris Johnson has resigned in England, the home of The Clash. I am the author of the new book, We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, and I find reason to hope. And one of the reasons I have hope is the influx of amazing immigrants to the United States whose energy, patriotism, faith and family orientation has really manifested itself in ways our Democrat friends didn't imagine. That's why I'm so excited to be joined by Giancarlo Sopo, the founder of Visto Media, which is a public relations firm. He previously led national Hispanic advertising for President Trump's 2020 campaign. Giancarlo, don't you want to be called Latinx? Did I mis-ethnicize you?
I identify as Cuban-X, actually.
Cuban-X. Oh, my God. As you know, I married a lovely Cuban woman and former model. I am that shallow.
You and me both.
Well, we need not prove our bravery in any other way. The simple fact is the Democrats see Hispanic Americans as a giant glob, a constituency that they can use and exploit. In fact, Hispanic Americans are a varied group of individuals. And that's how I think the Republicans see them. And I think that's one of the reasons they're coming over to our side, according to polls.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the framework through which the Democrats approach Hispanics tend to be that they view them, or they view us rather, as this oppressed minority group that we can only thrive in this country through their generous support. But, you know, no Hispanic comes to this country to feel like a victim. People come to this country to thrive. Hispanics have been very successful in the United States. If the U.S. Hispanic population was its own country, it would be by far the richest in all of Latin America. So that just goes to show you how much the Hispanics have been very successful in the United States. And we don't need the Democratic Party to defend us from systemic racism or any other thing that they want to concoct that they say that we're victims of. We're doing great. And we saw tremendous success with poverty rates declining significantly under President Trump and his administration. He had fantastic pro-growth policies. Hispanics lead the nation in the creation of small businesses. So Hispanics are doing just fine, and we want to succeed, and we don't like pandering, and we don't like this condescending tone that the Democrats take with us. And I think that, you know, combined with other cultural reasons that you alluded to earlier, say like Latinx, you know, Hispanics are very traditional in our views and our families, where Hispanics on average have an additional child compared to, say, like the average white family, more people per household, very hardworking. And so I think that's why the Democrats are struggling with Hispanics, is that there is a cultural mismatch between them and their preoccupation with political correctness versus Hispanics, who tend to be more traditional, don't really care a lot about PC. You know, we want to succeed. We're not preoccupied with pronouns.
Well, Giancarlo Sopo, that brings up an interesting point. Now, you were in charge of Hispanic outreach for Donald Trump. Is there a difference in the way that one would reach out to potential Hispanic voters, understanding that there are many different kinds of Hispanics? Are, you know, someone from Argentina may will be very different than someone who came from El Salvador in terms of culture, though they may speak the same language. Is there a difference in the way you advertise towards Hispanic Americans or have outreach to Hispanic Americans than Americans as a whole? And I'm kind of thinking maybe there isn't a difference.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, I'd say, overlap to, say, like Hispanics in South Texas, for instance, or in the southern part of Arizona. They care about border security the same way as non-Hispanics care about border security, right?
Is that geographic or is that, you know, based on original culture, pre-U.S. citizen culture?
More regional. Yeah, I think it's more regional, right? So like, you know, Hispanics in the Northeast, in major cities where we also saw big shifts from left to right in 2020. I'm talking about like Dominican neighborhoods in the Bronx. I'm talking about, you know, Puerto Rican communities in Philly, where we saw President Trump make about like 10-point gains.
Wow.
Among Hispanics. Yeah. You know, those communities, like people who live there care about issues like inflation, like, the cost of gasoline, crime is a huge issue in those communities, right? And that's not unique to the Hispanics who live there. It's you know, it's like everybody who lives there feels that, right? So I think there's a lot of overlap. I'd say overall, if you were to take a macro level 30,000 foot view on Hispanics, I'd say that there are a lot of similarities on demographically, you know, in terms of like, you know, like income levels and the issues that they care about between Hispanics and white working class voters. There's, I see a lot of similarities, but you know, you're going to communicate it differently. So when I was, when we were doing Hispanic advertising for President Trump, if we were talking, you know, we were speaking to Colombian Americans in South Florida, we would maybe draw references or parallels to some of the experiences that they had in Colombia, or the same with Cubans, right? So, I think there are some issues that are unique to these communities. Cubans are a great example of this. You know, the concern with socialism, the concern with rising left-wing extremism. A lot of white people or non-Hispanics have those concerns too, but it takes on a whole different I'd say it's like a whole different level of nuance with Cubans, given their own past experiences. You know, things like, for example, like my own family went through. They have a really good eye for spotting ideological extremists on the left.
Interesting. When you target particular communities within the Hispanic community, are you really just targeting the new immigrants and maybe first generation with an understanding that maybe the second generation's not really interested in being thought of as Hispanic, but just as American?
Yeah, you know, it varies. So it's funny you say that. If somebody were to try to advertise to me, right, or to my wife and I, right? My wife has only been in this country for 6 years. I was born and raised in this country, but it would be impossible to reach us if somebody was advertising to us, say, like through Univision or Telemundo. We just don't watch those channels. We consume, you know, we watch Fox or we stream movies on Netflix. So I do think his like advertisers have a really challenging time reaching these like second and third generation Hispanics or new immigrants who just don't consume Spanish television. Spanish TV is very important. I think it's still like a very crucial way of reaching Hispanics, also because of the role that grandparents play in Hispanic families. Something like family life.
Abuelo and abuela.
Yeah, family life tends to revolve around the abuelos. So if you're communicating to the abuelos and you're reaching out to them, they're going to talk to their grandkids about politics. They're going to tell them, hey, listen, I think, you know, this is what I'm reading in the news. So, yeah, so for sure, it varies also significantly by region. If there are some parts of Texas where you'll see that the demographic data say that it's overwhelmingly Hispanic, but you have to keep in mind that sometimes these are Hispanic communities who have been here for well over 100 years. They're like fourth or fifth generation Mexican American. They don't even speak Spanish in many cases. So it really varies by region. But that's a really good question because there's a lot of nuance and strategy that goes into that.
Well, one thing I've learned as I became more familiar with the Hispanic cultures, having married into it, is the dedication to service. You look at law enforcement, and there is a outsized number of folks of Hispanic descent. You look at the military, and of course, it is a home to many, many Hispanic Americans who have served bravely and written their history in blood on the pages of America's tale. And I think that dedication to service, we're going to see more Hispanic Americans who have that service background, and that's going to help them become involved in politics as they move forward, because now we're really looking for a lot of people who served. Our candidate in Texas 34, her husband's a Border Patrol agent, and now she is a candidate, but she's also our congressman, congresswoman. I think that's a route to success, and it also shows the dedication and investment to America that I don't think Democrats understand.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because when Democrats attack Border Patrol agents or they attack police officers in communities like Miami, which is where I'm from, but also in communities like McAllen, Texas, Brownsville, these border communities down in the Rio Grande Valley, the vast majority of police officers and Border Patrol agents are Hispanics. And Congresswoman Myra Flores is an excellent example of that. Her husband is a Border Patrol agent.
Yep.
She proudly wore a Border Patrol hat as she was campaigning on Election Day. I was with her that day. You know, she would just go up to people and shake their hands. She was wearing a Border Patrol hat.
Oh, she's nobody amazing. She's just great.
Yeah, nobody was scared. Nobody was turned off by that, because I think Hispanics understand, especially in these communities that are very working class communities, you need strong police officers and you need a strong border.
Well, thank you very much, Giancarlo Sopo of Vista Media. This is Kurt Schlichter, guest host on the Hugh Hewitt radio program, author of the new book, We'll Be Back, Fall and Rise of America. Stick around. We got one more segment to go on the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.